This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In a moment, we're going to review the particulars of a Charlotte Observer investigation into a murder conviction that appears to indicate that justice was, perhaps, not served. First, a recap of the latest in the ongoing saga of the aftermath of the passage of House Bill 2, which short-circuited the city of Charlotte's ordinance that would have broadened protections for LGBT citizens and allowed transgender people to use the bathroom of the gender with which they identify. Yesterday, Governor McCrory issued both a press release and video statement affirming the state's commitment to equality for all citizens, characterizing the Charlotte ordinance as government overreach, a solution in search of a problem, and announcing his decision to take steps in response to the national reaction to his signing of House Bill 2.
You know, after listening to people's feedback during the past several weeks on this issue, I have come to the conclusion that there's a great deal of misinformation, misinterpretation, confusion, passion, and frankly, selective outrage and hypocrisy, especially against the great state of North Carolina. But based on this feedback, I am taking action to affirm the state's commitment to privacy and equality. To that end, today I have signed an executive order with the goal of achieving that fine balance.
And here to fill us in on the details of Executive Order 93 is WFAE's Tom Bullock. Morning, Tom.
Good morning, Mike.
Why the timing of this executive order?
Well, if you listen to Pat McCrory, it's because he heard feedback. But who that feedback came from, he says, your average North Carolinians. But if you go down a list of companies, major employers who are starting to take direct stands on this, it's pretty powerful. Of course, you've got PayPal, who pulled out of bringing 400 jobs to Charlotte. Yesterday, you had Deutsche Bank announce that they were freezing plans to add 250 jobs in Cary. You have everyone from Bruce Springsteen and a number of artists saying they're not going to tour in North Carolina because of the bill. So, you know, you can give the governor the benefit of the doubt and say he's finally heard what a lot of North Carolinians were saying, or you can be a skeptic and say the business pressure is starting to have an impact.
So do the directives in the executive order do anything other than put lipstick on a pig?
You know, it's an interesting point. And the very first thing we had to do when we went through the actual text of the document, the governor says it does five big things. The first three are simply reaffirming House Bill 2. You know, you have to still use the bathroom or public restroom, locker room, whatever, that corresponds with the sex on your birth certificate. That is in his executive order. That is also in House Bill 2. He says he's affirming the private sector's right to establish its own restroom and locker room policies. That was also allowed in House Bill 2. And then, you know, he says that he is allowing the private sector and cities and counties, local municipalities, to put in their own non-discrimination ordinance and policies for their own workers. That also was in House Bill 2. So in three ways, it is really just window dressing. Mm. Now, there were two things that the governor did that are interesting and that do signify something of a change. First, he is expanding the non-discrimination ordinance for his own executive branch employees to include sexual orientation and gender identity. Now, that sounds really big. It is a significant move, but it only affects executive branch state workers. So it's a subset of all state workers. And nowhere in that video statement that you played a clip from did Governor McCrory say why it was so important to expand it for his workers, but not for all North Carolinians. And then the second thing, Mike, that the bill, the executive order rather actually does is it's the first time that McCrory is calling for a section of House Bill 2 to be repealed by the General Assembly. And specifically, it's the provision in the law that bars someone suing an employer or someone else in state court over discrimination. He is now saying we need to repeal that and reestablish North Carolinians' right to sue in state court.
I'm confused about something. You just mentioned that the protections were extended to people who work for him in the executive branch, but didn't the order also affirm local governments' rights to establish non-discrimination employment policies for their own employees?
Well, actually, that's what I was talking about before. It has always been allowed under House Bill 2. So let's say the city of Charlotte wants to have their own non-discrimination protections for their own employees. That right has never been taken away by House Bill 2. What House Bill 2 did, Mike, was eliminate the ability for a municipality to pass broader protections for LGBT individuals that would extend beyond a county or a city's own payroll.
So would you agree that the biggest provision here actually may be the fact that the governor is now seeking legislation to reinstate the right to sue in state court for discrimination as opposed to having to go to a federal court?
I think that's right. And even if it's not the most impactful provision, it certainly represents a major acknowledgement. I mean, you know, House Bill 2 is 3 weeks old now, actually today. And as this thing has continued to roll on and the controversy has continued, you've heard time and again from Governor McCrory and other leading Republican lawmakers that the law was simply about bathrooms. That's never been the case. It is a very broad law. So this represents really a major acknowledgement that the law did more than simply define who uses which restroom. And because of that, now McCrory is saying we do need to change this law. So it is a major plank in this executive order. It's also a major acknowledgement by the governor.
In the scheme of things, is this order aimed at calming national fears or national criticism and putting a fresh coat of paint on what some see as our damaged image nationally? Or is this more for internal consumption among local municipalities and citizens of North Carolina?
It's a tough question to answer. We don't know exactly what went on inside Pat McCrory's head when he signed this executive order. But realistically, given the limited scope of the executive order, it only affects, you know, executive order or executive branch employees. He's calling for legislation to be a part of the legislation to be repealed. But of course, McCrory can't do that on his own. And other points are simply reaffirming House Bill 2. At best, this seems like the one thing that Pat McCrory could do on his own. So you can take that to mean that the governor is finally acting on this, or you can take it to mean it could be just, again, you know, a fresh coat of paint, as you said.
And what has the reaction been?
You know, it's been pretty mixed. The ACLU, the Human Rights Commission, they're all pointing to the fact that this bill, or this executive order, rather, does very little, and the federal case that was brought is going forward. You actually even have the Conservative Family Research Council, who came out with a statement last night, and they say that this does nothing to change the law that Pat McCrory signed not that long ago. The key reaction really is from Republican lawmakers, because they're the ones who would be needed to, you know, change this legislation. And so far, we're still waiting to hear what Senate President Pro Tem Phil Berger and House Speaker Tim Moore will do.
If I'm not mistaken, the governor has called a press conference for this hour this morning. And if that's true, we will have details on what comes out of that press conference throughout the day here on WFAE. WFAE's Tom Bullock, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
If someone in America is accused of committing a crime, they are technically presumed innocent until found guilty after trial, usually with a jury of their peers. Those jurors sit through the trial, sift through the evidence, and make their decision based on their being satisfied that the defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It is our society's hope that this system leads to convictions of people who are guilty of committing a crime. But sometimes innocent people find themselves convicted. And recent true crime programs like Serial and Making a Murderer have brought renewed focus to the criminal justice system and raised questions about the guilt of convicted killers. In 2008, Ira Yarmolenko was found dead on a remote riverbank west of Charlotte. A Gaston County man who was fishing nearby was convicted in 2011 of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without parole. But that man, Mark Carver, insists he didn't do it.
I told him I wasn't pleading guilty to something I didn't do. I'm not guilty and I ain't going to plead guilty. Because that DNA on that car is not mine and that handprint's ain't mine. Because I didn't go around it. How could it be mine?
No, I didn't do it. Ain't no way in the world I'd done it. Ain't no way.
That comment from Mr. Carver came from a jailhouse interview conducted by the Charlotte Observer. It is a tiny part of an investigation by the paper that led to a six-part series written by reporter Elizabeth Leland, who spent more than a year interviewing investigators, lawyers, witnesses, medical experts, and forensics scientists. And she joins us now to share her findings. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike.
Also with us in our Spirit Square studio is Gary Schwab, the Enterprise editor for The Observer. If you saw Spotlight, the movie, I guess you're the guy who runs Spotlight, the Boston Globe version of Enterprise, correct?
Well, I would love to be that, yes.
Okay. Well, welcome as
well. Thank you, Mike.
Why did The Observer start an investigation into the Mark Carver case? Because this takes a lot of time, effort, money, a year of investigation. Why did you do it?
Well, several things piqued my interest about the case. One of our other editors, Doug Miller, began seeing tweets from a woman who ran a website saying to free Mark Carver, and she'd done all this investigation and believed he was innocent. And I looked at the website, and it was intriguing. And from there, I went and saw an original jailhouse interview that he gave the local Gaston Gazette in 2008 when he was arrested. And Mark Carver appears in that interview to be completely befuddled and confused about what's going on and why he's arrested. But what made me think that there might be some credibility to this was when I found out the North Carolina Center for Actual Innocence was investigating, because they've done a lot of work to exonerate people they believe are innocent. And then the final thing, I've been a reporter for 40 years, and this has never happened in my career. I covered courts for 3 years for the News and Observer in Raleigh, and I've done a lot of legal reporting in Charlotte as well. I called one of Mark Carver's defense lawyers who had represented him at trial and started asking about the case. And he proclaimed that Mark Carver was innocent, and lawyers do that. It's the nature of our legal system, and, you know, they might not be innocent. But when I asked Ratchford, he seemed genuine, and I said, "Do you feel responsible for Mark Carver being in prison?" And he choked up, and I thought, wow, he really thinks this guy didn't do it.
Mm. We'll talk about the defense tactics in this trial, or lack of tactics in this trial, as we go through this conversation. Let's catch listeners up on the details, however, if they don't take the paper or they haven't read the story and they don't remember the Mark Carver incident and the death of that young woman. It involved a 20-year-old sophomore from UNC Charlotte. She died on May 5th, 2008, which, despite a conviction, you continue to call a mystery. Why?
Well, there's even when he was charged, there were a lot of people who weren't certain that he did it. The case was, from a prosecutorial point, was fairly weak. They had some DNA that they felt proved that he touched the car. And they also had an interrogation where Carver reportedly indicated how tall she was. And that was their two strongest pieces of evidence. After the conviction, what I've found out since we've run this story, there were so many people in the area who didn't believe the fisherman killed Ira. Mm. Some people believe someone else killed her. Some people believe other things might have happened.
Her car had gone down an embankment. The front wheels were in the water of the Catawba River. The driver's side door was open. She was on the ground. Her neck was bound with a bungee cord and some other materials as well. Who found her?
There were two jet skiers who had set off downriver from a little boat landing and were going off on a picnic lunch. It was a day in May that had warmed up, and it was really pretty. And they were scooting up the river and saw this metallic blue thing that shouldn't be on this kind of wild stretch of river. And so they eased over to take a closer look, and it was a car, mm-hmm. and then they saw Ira's body beside it.
We're going to find out who Mark Carver is, the person who has been convicted of her murder, when we come back. And we'll also speak with the executive director of the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, the organization that you've alluded to, who is getting involved, who has gotten involved, has been involved in this case for several years. Elizabeth Leland is with us from the Charlotte Observer, along with Gary Schwab, the Enterprise editor there, talking about a series that appeared this week in the paper called Death by the River, which you can read on charlotteobserver.com. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Queen City Audio, Video, and Appliances, purveyors of premium appliances since 1952, including the new Obsidian interior refrigerator from Gen Air, designed to showcase food like never before. Details at queencityonline.com. And Tyndall Subaru Gastonia test drives are available for the new 2016 Crosstrek SUV with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. In the debate over the passage of HB 2, prohibiting discrimination protections for LGBT individuals and forcing transgender people to use the bathroom of the gender on their birth certificate, there has been one perspective that has largely gone unheard, that of transgender people. They feel there has been confusion and misconceptions about what it means to be transgender, so we offer them a forum to talk about that and more on this program tomorrow. at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama has called for nearly $2 billion in emergency funding for Zika preparedness. The mosquito that can carry the virus is present in about 30 U.S. states. Assessing the risk of Zika and what can be done to reduce the threat.
The Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Elizabeth Leland, staff writer for the Charlotte Observer, and Gary Schwab, enterprise editor. Together, they help put together this series, Death by the River, which questions the guiltiness of a man who has been convicted of murder in the death of Ira, I can't think of her last name.
Yarmolenko.
Yarmolenko, thank you very much. Mark Carver. Who is Mark Carver? He is 47 now, but who is he?
Well, he was actually fishing just about 100 yards down the river from where Ira's body was found that day. He's a local Gaston County man. He worked in the mills for years and became disabled due to carpal tunnel syndrome. And so he and his cousin Neil Cassidy spent most of their days fishing. That was their real passion that they enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. And he was on the riverbank that day.
Yes.
Not too far from where the car came down the bank. How far from where the car came down?
It was about, photographer Todd Sumlin and I were out there, and we both walked it off. It was about 100 yards.
Okay. Your articles say that Carver insists that he did not kill this woman, that he never wavered in that assertion the entire time, and that he has offered repeatedly to take a polygraph, a lie detector test. He says, in your first article, every day when I get up, I think about what I'm doing here in prison, how I got here, because I'm no murderer. Was he ever allowed to take that polygraph?
They gave a polygraph to his cousin, Neil Cassidy, and Cassidy passed the polygraph. I was told that Carver, you know, there was some question about whether he would take one, and he said he would take one, but he was never actually given one.
Why not?
I do not know.
Is that unusual, do you think? For somebody to volunteer to take one but not be asked to take one, particularly when the other person arrested for this crime was given one?
That's a good question. I don't know if Chris Mumma, she's a lawyer, she may have more.
Well, let's bring her into the conversation. Chris Mumma is executive director of the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, which coordinates the Innocence Projects at several North Carolina law schools. They're dedicated to investigating post-conviction claims of actual innocence asserted by unrepresented North Carolina inmates, and they are now involved and have been for several years in Mark Carver's case. Welcome, Chris. Nice to have you with us.
Good morning.
How unusual is that for a person to volunteer to take a polygraph for his co-defendant or the other person accused of murder in the same case taking the polygraph, but his being no one ever responding to his request to take a polygraph test?
So there can be a number of reasons for that decision. Polygraph evidence is not admissible at trial,
all right.
So there could be a question of cost. There also could be a question of the person's ability to understand the questions through the examination and be evaluated clearly. So I don't know that those are the things that were taken into consideration in this case or not.
The Center on Actual Innocence, I understand, rejects 98% of the cases that come to the organization. People bring cases to you, relatives, friends, even inmates themselves who are asserting their innocence bring cases to you. You reject 98% of them. I'm told that you only take cases that you're just about 100% certain will win and that your track record is perfect. Is that all correct?
Well, we only take cases that we believe there's some investigative avenues to pursue. So we do reject about 98%, and there could be a number of reasons for that, from it doesn't seem like a credible claim, which I will be the first to admit is most of the cases, to there's no new evidence to pursue.
So what made the Mark Carver case stand out to you so that you took his case?
We believe there was other evidence to pursue. It was when we read the transcript from Mark's case, it was just really troubling just on its face on the limited amount of evidence that resulted in his guilt. So it was a pretty compelling case from the very beginning.
And I want to be clear, because there are a lot of people who are law and order, throw the book at them, throw them in a jail cell and throw away the key kind of people, and maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but you've participated in the exoneration, as I understand it, of 41 prisoners in North Carolina. Does that mean that those prisoners were wrongly convicted, that in fact they are innocent, that they did not commit the crimes of which they were accused, or were there other extenuating factors that led to a wrongful conviction and got them out of prison?
Well, first I need to clarify that. I did not participate in 41 exonerations. That would be quite the feat. There have been 41 exonerations that are tracked by the National Registry on Exonerations in North Carolina. And some of those cases include cases where the person was convicted and went to the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, and their conviction was overturned and they were not retried. A lot of people would say that that is an indication of the system working. So the cases we work on are actually cases that have been through that process, the appeal has been upheld, the full trial and appeal process is exhausted, and we're looking at the case fresh. We have participated in a number of exonerations, but not 41.
I guess the point I was trying to get at is when you are successful at exonerating somebody and they are released from prison, are they in fact released because they were innocent and wrongly convicted, or because you've gotten them out on a technicality?
No, we do not take cases on technicality.
Okay. All right.
There are other avenues to pursue on technicalities. The cases we take, if you have any involvement, planning, participation afterwards or during, then we will not take your case.
Elizabeth, you report that what makes Carver's conviction especially troubling, and this is a quote, is that trial attorneys never presented a case in his defense. Why not?
They had a strategy. Now, they did cross-examine. I don't want you to, think they didn't ask any questions. In the court, the way the courts proceed, if you do not present a case, you get the final closing argument.
Mm-hmm.
They felt that the government's case was so weak against Carver, they assumed he would go free. They thought the judge might even throw out the case after the state's evidence, which didn't happen. But they thought they could be more persuasive to the jurors by having the final closing argument, which is the final say, so to speak, and that they could present their case that way.
Mm-hmm. So they did cross-examine prosecution witnesses.
Oh, yeah.
But when the prosecution rested, they rested as well.
They rested as well.
They presented nothing.
They called no witnesses.
Is that unusual?
No. I mean, it's a defense tactic. I did talk to a number of attorneys as I started to investigate this case who said they were surprised at that tactic in the Mark Carver case because touch DNA mixtures, it's such a new field that they felt that there could have been challenges there and that, there were a number of things they could have done. And I might want to bring in Gary Schwab here as my editor. It was actually Gary's idea to sort of frame the whole series about the defense that he never got. And I thought that was an interesting approach.
Gary?
We often, when we are doing investigations, it's important to me to look hard at the facts, but also to tell the story behind the case or behind the investigation so people can really empathize and understand more of what's going on here. And so we often look to think about how will we frame the story, how will we tell the story. We had a horrible plane crash years ago in Charlotte, and we investigated what went wrong, but we also asked Elizabeth, who is a wonderful reporter and a storyteller, to tell the story of who were the people inside the plane that died. And once you understand that inside that plane was a young girl who had saved up money to go with her father, and the last words in the plane crash from the recovered box were her yelling, "Daddy," you start to care a little bit more about the story. And so I think on this one, the defense that he never got became a framework for our story.
It's a tragedy because she's a 20-year-old girl. She was moving from Charlotte to Chapel Hill to go to UNC Chapel Hill after attending UNC Charlotte, and she'd said goodbye to all of her friends. She'd said goodbye to the place that she used to work up by the university, the coffee shop that she worked in. And it's a 19-minute drive or a 19-mile drive from that coffee shop to where her car ended up being. And it took her 19 minutes to get there, and you know that because you have video coverage of that from a security camera, and you see her turning off the main road onto a dirt road, which ultimately would lead to this location. Mark Carver was found fishing nearby. He spoke with officers that day. Why did officers make the connection? Because he spoke to them several times. They came over and talked to him. He said he knew nothing. He was unaware of what had happened on the other side of the 100 yards. He went away. He went and took his kids to pick them up at school. He came back to get his fishing net, and officers talked to him again. And somebody pointed out in one of these articles that why would he come back if he was guilty? Well, a lot of people come back to the scene of the crime. But what's the story with Mark Carver? Why did officers not arrest him on contact, but they arrested him much later?
I was told they didn't suspect them, There was some talk by the initial responders that they thought maybe Ira had actually killed herself. The medical examiner said no, this was a homicide, and so their focus began looking for who might have killed her. And I think as they ruled out other people, they kept coming back to the fishermen. But it wasn't until 7 months later that they got the break they needed to bring the charges.
Carver was at the river that morning, as you said, fishing with his buddy Neil Cassidy, who was also arrested at one point and also charged. What happened to him?
Well, he died the night before his trial. Cassidy had a heart attack, I think, when he was in his 30s. He had severe heart problems, and it was actually the morning of the day before his trial. He was having breakfast and started having trouble breathing and got up. He was on his way to take a shower and collapsed.
The victim, when did she leave the coffee shop in the university area?
Well, that's a good question. In the trial, they said she left there at 10:50, and as you clocked it out, it would take 19 minutes to get to the Stowe Family YMCA. I'm not sure, Chris, you may know this. I don't know if you can even talk about this. My sense is there wasn't a surveillance video from Jackson's Java, so maybe that was just people saying.
Yeah, we saw her last at 10:50 or so. What do you have something that says exactly when she left the coffee shop, Chris?
No, we don't have any. There's no surveillance from the coffee shop. What we have is when her car is seen at the YMCA.
And we do have a timestamp on that, so we know that she arrived at a certain time, shortly after 11 o'clock. And Mark Carver claims that he arrived at the river at 11:30 and heard nothing. Of course, if that's true, then her car would have already probably gone down the embankment.
It could have.
At that point. Her body was discovered around 1 p.m. by some jet skiers. Did the coroner affix a time of death?
No, he did not. And I think if I remember correctly, he said in the trial that he could not say what the time of death is. I talked to a couple of other medical examiners. I think that's something they shy away from a lot. Do you find that, Chris, that it's hard to pinpoint the exact time of death?
Yes, there's a window of time, but the window of time in this case wouldn't make any difference.
Okay. Elizabeth reports that when she began her investigation in the Gaston County Courthouse, Chris, she expected to find a huge file in this case, but instead was handed an inch-thick manila folder with routine legal motions and very little else. I'm sure you've seen that same file. What does the size and or the contents of that file tell you?
That's just the court file. It doesn't necessarily mean anything. What's important would be the size of the defense file, the size of the prosecution file, and how much was shared between the two.
And some first responders thought that her death was, in fact, a suicide, but the medical examiner categorized it as death by homicide. Is that at all in question?
Well, there are some people, I call them amateur sleuths, who are convinced of that. I flew up to Maryland and talked to Ira's brother, and the family says that she did not kill herself. They're pretty sure of that. And a number of her friends I've talked with, a close friend called me after the series was over, and just said there was no reason and that they strongly do not think she killed herself.
As we discovered in a previous series on medical examiners, which I believe appeared in the Charlotte Observer, and we've done a couple of programs on it, North Carolina law does not require medical examiners to go to the scene of a person's death to rule on the cause. And in this case, Dr. Chris Nguyen simply looked over photos of the scene. Why did he believe that these photos indicated that she was murdered? Or is that what he believes?
No, he believes it was a homicide, yeah. From the autopsy, he concluded it was a homicide. And during the trial, he was questioned whether the photos, which obviously he did not see the scene himself, but did these photographs support his conclusion? And he said they did.
Police considered 10 people who had been in the area of the river at the time that she died, but settled only on Carver and Cassidy. Why?
Because of their DNA. They sent off DNA samples that were lifted from the car, and they used like Q-tips. So they swab the car, and then they seal these samples up, take them to Raleigh to the SBI lab, and there a forensic scientist examined the DNA and said she found a mixture, and that's the key word in this case, a mixture of DNA in three different places on the car, and she said the predominant profile in one place matched Mark Carver's DNA profile, and in two other places matched Neil Cassidy.
So let's be clear about the DNA part of this. This is very complicated.
It is very complicated.
Mr. Carver and Mr. Cassidy both submitted to swabs of their
mouths, right?
Which is how they collect the DNA on a suspect. But then they went and they got from the car what is called touch DNA. Define that. Chris, what is touch DNA?
Touch DNA is simply where a limited number of skin cells are left behind from where someone may have touched a surface. So it's not a fluid, it's not blood or another bodily fluid. It's just the skin cells from touching the surface.
So if they found three spots on the car that indicated that the DNA of the two suspects that we've been talking about were in those spots or amongst other DNA, mixed in with other DNA, how unusual is that? If you didn't touch the car, would it be possible for that to happen?
What we're seeing in mixtures, and that's what happens when you have just a limited number of skin cells, then you can pick up skin cells from a number of different people. When you're seeing a profile, more than one profile, and you're interpreting the mixture, there can be complications in if you settle on two people as part of the mixture, you could reach one conclusion. If you assume there's three people, you might reach another conclusion, and there's oftentimes no way to tell how many people are part of that mixture.
We have to come back to this after the break because this is so confusing and so important to this trial. Chris Mumma is with us. She's the executive director of the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, along with Elizabeth Leland and Gary Schwab, who are from the Charlotte Observer. Elizabeth wrote the series Death by the River. We're coming right back as Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doctors Making House Calls. Over 75 clinicians making more than 85,000 home visits annually, providing comprehensive primary care to patients in their home, workplace, or senior community. Information and registration at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. And UNC Charlotte Executive Education now offering programs in analytics, innovation, leadership, and ethics. More at exec-ed.uncc.edu. President Obama has called for nearly $2 billion in emergency funding for Zika preparedness. The mosquito that can carry the virus is present in about 30 U.S. states, including this one. So, in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, they'll be talking about the threat of Zika and what can be done to reduce the risks. If you'd like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Reach us at Charlotte Talks on the Twitter or at WFAE on Facebook.
This week on All Things Considered, the Democratic presidential primary moves to New York.
Oh my gosh, it is so great to be in New York. And
I am very proud that I was born here in New York City.
With the vote just days away, the stakes are high for Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. We're here every afternoon between now and then and beyond with the latest political news on All Things Considered. Listen every afternoon.
From 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the investigation into the case of Mark Carver, who was accused of killing 20-year-old Ira Yarmolenko in 2008. He has been in prison for several years now, serving a life sentence, and yet the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, which gets involved in very few cases, is involved in his case because they believe he's innocent. He insists and has insisted since the very beginning that he is innocent, and that was the subject of a series of articles that appeared recently in the Charlotte Observer, written by Elizabeth Leland with the help of Gary Schwab, the Enterprise editor there, and we're talking about that this morning. Let's go back to the evidence, this touch DNA evidence. Investigators found none of Mark Carver's or his fishing buddy's fingerprints on Yarmolenko's car, no fingerprints. None of their DNA was found on the bindings that were around her neck, which could have resulted in her asphyxiation, which is what the medical examiner said she died from. She did not die from a car accident. She died from asphyxiation. They found no DNA under her fingernails. So how did DNA evidence end up on the car? And if it's on the car, why is that an indication that they killed her if nothing of their DNA was on her body?
Well, that was the argument that the trial attorneys made and tried to convince the jurors that point, that the fact that their DNA is found on the car does not necessarily mean they killed her. I think, Chris, I don't know if you can talk about this, but my sense is that there's a possibility it could have gotten there by what is known as secondary transfer. There's also perhaps a possibility that it wasn't their DNA.
So there's several possibilities. The possibility that it was a mixture of their DNA, possibility that it was a mixture and it was more than two people, and the mixture is being interpreted incorrectly, or the possibility that it was secondary transfer, which means that someone had contact with them, and then that person had contact with the car and transferred their DNA.
So let's talk about that for a second, because they insisted that they never knew the car was there, that they never touched the car. But their DNA is mixed in with the DNA of other people in three spots on this car. Police officers went to the two of these fishermen on the other side of the bank and spoke with them. And I assume that I think you write in your article that they asked for their driver's and fisher's license.
Yeah, just Mark Carver. Neil Cassidy had gone then.
So the license was handed to the officer. Is it even within the realm of possibility with how touch DNA works that because he touched that fisherman's license, and because it was handed to him by Mark Carver, that Mark's DNA got on the officer in some way, the officer then touched the car, and that explains the mixture of the touch DNA. Is that possible?
Yeah.
That is possible. I'd say there was additional contact that would make it even more possible, which would be a handshake with someone who had been at the river for a couple of hours and was warm and sweating, and then there's a handshake between the officer and the person who's been fishing.
Is it likely?
It is a possibility that needs to be explored.
And it was not explored in the trial or in the investigation leading to the trial?
We have not seen any of the DNA samples in any of the investigating officers as part of the forensic analysis.
One thing that I think may be important to point out is that in 2008, when Mark Carver was charged based on that DNA evidence, this whole issue of touch DNA had just sort of exploded on the national scene. You probably remember the JonBenet Ramsey case,
right?
And her parents were eliminated as suspects based on touch DNA. I talked to a number of forensic scientists, and lawyers who specialize in forensics, and they all cautioned that we really need to be careful about touch DNA mixtures, that for years DNA was considered the gold standard. You may remember the Duke lacrosse case where the lacrosse players were able to get off because of the DNA. And I talked with one of their attorneys, Brad Bannon, who has done all sorts of research into DNA and taught himself about it. And he said it's now pretty common knowledge that mixtures, as a general rule, are very problematic. They are where the most human error and bias come into play when lab analysts make determinations of what is or is not a genetic marker.
On the other hand, you write that Carver told reporters that he took a DNA test to prove his innocence. You also say that when a relative advised him to get a lawyer because the police were looking into him, he declined, believing that doing so would make police suspect that he was guilty, when in fact he said he was not. But then you reveal that he was on medication for schizophrenia and that he and Cassidy, his fishing buddy, each had prior arrests on felony charges. Are those red flags?
I think to the investigators they were.
Should they not be?
I think it's a perfectly legitimate, you know, consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you dig a little deeper into the charges against him, one, they were all dismissed, so you have to be careful about that. And there were some extenuating circumstances.
Is he schizophrenic?
I don't have any firsthand knowledge, but that is what the prosecutor said.
Chris?
He has some medical conditions, but that nothing that would impact this case.
So he's on medication, or he was on medication allegedly for schizophrenia, but he's not schizophrenic?
He had a completely normal daily life.
Okay. Based on his history and his character and the slim evidence in the case, his attorneys were confident that that he would win at trial, that the case would probably be thrown out by the judge. Even prosecutors deliberated, I read in your series, about whether or not the case, to even try the case based on the weaknesses that they themselves saw in the case. Was all of this unknown to the jury?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, even when the attorneys argued before the judge to dismiss the case, that the jurors had been taken out of the courtroom.
You also write that someone actually confessed to this murder, not these men, but someone else actually confessed to this murder to Channel 9's Erica Bryant.
Right.
And the confession was just disregarded or dismissed. Why?
My understanding, and I don't have any first-hand knowledge, is that they determined that the guy was infatuated with Bryant, saw it as a way to get a chance to talk with her, and that some of his alleged co-defendants were actually in jail at the time they allegedly murdered Kara.
A lot of defendants who are guilty say they're not, say they're innocent.
Oh, yeah.
And they claim it to the very end because there's always a shot they might get off. He's always said he was innocent. Carver would have gotten a reduced sentence, 8 to 14 years. He'd be out by now, I think.
Probably,
As opposed to life, if he would have pleaded guilty to second-degree murder, and he refused based on what he says is his innocence. Chris, from your experience, how often does that happen? If a person is really guilty and has a chance to get out of prison early, if he says, I'm guilty to second-degree murder, how often does it happen that they refuse to change their plea?
Yeah, but with a sentence of 8 to 14 years, if he had been guilty, that would be a very attractive sentence to take. So that is definitely something that we look at when we're evaluating the cases. With regard to whether people always claim they're innocent, not typically. A lot of times defense attorneys just don't ask the question.
Mm.
But when a defendant has that attorney-client privilege and they can say whatever they want and it's protected, so a lot of times the conversations with attorneys are much more honest than you might hear publicly.
During the trial, it was revealed by one of the officers who interrogated Mark Carver, Detective Derek Terry, that Carver, although he claimed previously to have been unaware of her presence on the river, called the victim a little thing and said he came up to hear on him, indicating his face, and then told police, I never seen her. Was that a pivotal moment in the trial?
Oh, yeah. The judge told me that was the turning point in the trial. He said that a lot of jurors don't buy the scientific DNA stuff, but he felt that was the turning point.
Okay. So that's an indication that even though he said he never saw her, how would he know that she was little?
Exactly.
Because he said she came up to hear on him. You have a video, Chris, of that moment in the police interrogation, which tells a different story. What does it show?
Well, I think the defense attorneys had a video that was part of the investigation and the interrogation of Mark Carver that shows that the term little thing and the reference to her height came from the investigating officer. So those were his words, and then he made the gesture as far as how tall she was, and then Mark basically mimicked that gesture.
And then said, "I never seen her." Gary?
Yes, he repeatedly said, I guess, and said he had seen her on the news. And he also was making an assumption she was about the same age as his daughter,
right.
And he was putting all that together.
So do you view this as an honest and uncontested mistake by the detective or as a manipulation of the truth in an effort to get a conviction?
The interrogation uses techniques, and that is part of the technique that is used often in Reed. It's called Reed interrogation method, and so I think it was an intentional to try and get Mark to acknowledge.
But I mean, the fact that the way the detective told the story on the stand is counter to what is actually on the tape. So do you see that as a manipulation of the evidence or simply an honest mistake?
I think it is telling just one side of the story, and the other side of the story should have been told by the defense.
I think, Mike, when when Elizabeth brought me into this story as I became her editor, that was one of the things that struck me when I read through this and I saw in the transcript that Mark Carver stood up and held up his hand to say this is how tall she was.
Yeah.
And then I started to think about the question of him telling him to stand up. And I went around and asked my family and others, so stand up and tell me how tall somebody is. And often they would put their hand up just by the very act of asking somebody to stand up, I think would influence that. Then we found this whole other piece that really changed that.
You shared this information with the judge, the trial judge, and you say he was shocked and believed that knowledge of the actual exchange, what actually is shown on the videotape, might have made a difference to the jury, and yet the jury never saw it because during the trial, after the prosecution rested, the defense also rested without presenting any evidence, without producing any witnesses or guest experts. Did they not cross-examine the detective and try to bring that out?
There was a passing reference. I don't think they made the point as slowly, as methodically. I think, if I recall correctly, the defense attorney said, and when the SBI agent told Carver to get up, did he do such and so? And I think that probably went right over the head of the jurors.
Aside from that piece of evidence, were there other things that you uncovered that you felt the defense could have used had they presented a case to the jury?
Yeah, there was. I think the one thing that really hit me was when I talked with James Beatty, who had seen the life-saving crews driving down to the river, and he used to fish at the same spot where Mark Carver was that day. So he and his brother decided to go down there and see what was going on. And Beatty described the conversation that he had with Carver that afternoon. They were just chatting by the river. He said Carver got out this scrapbook that was full of all the fish he'd caught over the years, and they talked about their family. And when I asked him, you know, specific questions about Mark Carver, was he agitated? And he said, no. I said, well, is he wet? Because, you know, one of the prosecution's theories is that they dragged her into the river hoping to drown her. He said he wasn't wet. And, you know, we went. And when I went down there, I got.
It wasn't muddy either.
It wasn't muddy. I got cut up by briars. I mean, I was bloodied. And I said, was he bloody? You know, and so he said it was just like any other day. And I thought that was really telling.
Hmm. And he wanted to testify?
I don't know that he would have wanted to testify, but he said he was always puzzled by the fact that no one came and talked to him or asked him to testify.
Chris, had he testified, would that have had an impact on the outcome, do you think?
I think it could have had an impact, yes. A conversation close in time to when the murder would have occurred. And you pointed out earlier that why would Mark come back to the scene, and sometimes the murderers do, but I think the bigger question is, if he had just committed this murder, why would he have stayed there?
Yeah. What do you need? What is your process going forward? What happens now?
Well, we hear about the wheels of justice turning slowly, and that just depends on the approach of both sides. We always try and have a cooperative effort with the district attorney's office in relooking cases, and we will definitely try that in Mark's case.
We asked the Gaston County District Attorney, Locke Bell, to join us on this program today, but he writes that due to prior commitments, he would not be able to attend, but he did speak with WBTV News months ago, and said that he had not changed his mind on this case.
I have no doubts whatsoever. We put in My office and the police together put in several thousand hours into this. I have no doubt whatsoever that Mark Carver is guilty of first-degree murder of this young lady.
Now, a judge panel by the North Carolina Court of Appeals has already upheld the conviction, as has the North Carolina Supreme Court. So given what the Observer has uncovered, what the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence believes to be true, where do you take the case?
Well, I would say that there's been 327 DNA exonerations across the country, and all the prosecutors in those cases were confident that the defendant was guilty.
Chris Mumma is executive director of the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence. Elizabeth Leland and Gary Schwab with The Observer and the Death by the River series. An email says very quickly, how are we supposed to know what is fact and what is opinion, because you end your article with an opinion? How are we? Very quickly, 5 seconds, 10 seconds.
We did this story very differently through Elizabeth's eyes as she observed this, and this is her story.
Okay. Thank you for the hour. I appreciate it. It was interesting. You can read it at charlotteobserver.com.